Hey, it's Francis, and this week we're revisiting one of our favorite episodes. It's all about the food of Mexico. Fun fact, for one of the segments in this episode, we did a tortilla taste test in our very professional radio studio. I hope to be in a studio again. And like our guest brought his own electric griddle, he plugged it in to heat up the tortillas. We almost got kicked out of the studio because it turns out you really can't have a large searing surface running on electricity when you're also running thousands of dollars of high-end recording equipment right next to it. Anyway, here's the show and the sacrifice we almost made for it. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. Now, if you're listening to this, chances are that you love Mexican food, and I know that because just about everyone in America loves Mexican food. 25 years ago, we found out that Americans spent more money on salsa than they do on ketchup, and a study last year revealed that Mexican restaurants are the second most common kind of restaurant in America, edging out pizzerias. So this week, we want to take a look at some of the ways Mexican food looks and tastes and feels in America today. Now, what we don't have is a full tour of Mexican food across the country, and honestly, you might be a little appalled that we don't have a story from the Southwest or from Chicago, for that matter, but that's kind of the point, because there are so many stories to tell and so many ideas of what Mexican food is in America, there's no way we'd fit them all into an hour. But we're thrilled about what we do have, a fascinating story about the restaurant that inspired Taco Bell, a chat with a chef on how to make tacos with whatever you have in your fridge, a conversation about Mexican food in a surprising corner of the South, and a pastry chef gives us a masterclass in flan. But if you want to talk about Mexican food, you kind of have to start with a tortilla. In its industrial form, you know, a tortilla is basically an edible plate or like a super handy glove made out of food, which, you know, I'm not really going to knock, but if you get to the heart of a great tortilla, if you get to taste real corn and feel its chew and how it gives everything you eat with it a grassy taste of earth, well, then you're talking about something special. You're talking about tortillas as they were meant to be. Now, Jorge Gaviria is obsessed with tortillas as they were meant to be. He's the head of a company called Macienda that's all about supporting people who grow native varieties of corn in Mexico and using traditional methods to make truly delicious tortillas here in the U.S. So Jorge's here to tell us about what makes a tortilla great. So Jorge, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Francis. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I have to ask you a question, and that is, I'm sure you know this guy, I know this guy, everyone knows this guy. The guy who always, like, every time you have a pizza, he's like, well, you know, the crust is the best part of the pizza. Like, that guy is always, he always has to say that, right?
Right.
So why is it that no one knows anyone who says when you have a taco, well, the tortilla is the best part of a taco?
You know, I think fortunately that's changing. And we have a lot of people to thank for that. You know, a lot of chefs have been doing a lot of hard work to sort of elevate the merits of a humble tortilla. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that, you know, it's what's so fascinating about a tortilla, right? It's everywhere. I mean, this is a $12 billion industry in the U.S., which is
seriously,
it's a lot of tortillas, right? But nobody really understands where they come from. Or I should say a majority of folks in the U.S. don't understand the history of it or that this is a food that honestly it's sort of like an OG superfood. It's been around for thousands of years and I think honestly catalyzed, you know, an entire civilization to existence, right? And yet, yeah, to your point, it's kind of an afterthought, even though it's actually the foundation to the entire dish.
Yeah.
You know, I think a tortilla to me is it's this ongoing challenge. It is something that is sort of at odds with industrial agriculture and industrial food. We have really kind of changed what a tortilla looks like in the last 50 years pretty significantly to the point where we almost don't recognize it anymore.
What do you mean?
Well, in the sense of, you know, tortillas, like I said, have a really long history in the world and a deeper significance than I think most folks will ever understand. You know, the original tortilla comes from corn that ultimately requires this alchemy process called nixtamalization. Mm. Nixtamalization is a mineralization process. It is the process of essentially indigestible piece of corn, mm-hmm. field corn, sitting in an alkaline bath for a number of hours, which is what imparts all of the sort of the natural nutrition that's found in each corn kernel. And it also breaks down the the pericarp or the skin of the corn kernel, the kind of thing that gets stuck in your teeth after you eat popcorn.
Yeah.
So that, and that sort of not only makes it more digestible, it makes it easier to mill, it just breaks it down,
okay.
is also rendering it nutritious in the process.
Yeah. So it actually like unlocks the nutrients, which otherwise our bodies can't access.
Exactly.
So once you've nixtamalized corn, I understand, then you grind it, and that's kind of it, right? It's water and corn, and then the lime used to nixtamalize it, ground into dough, there's masa, and tortillas are made from that masa.
The best tortillas are made from that kind
the
of masa.
Exactly. From that masa.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is the difference between the best tortillas and the less than best tortillas?
You know, this is part of what I find so fascinating about the industry is that we found all sorts of shortcuts to that 12 to 14 hour nixtamalization process, right? And we found shortcuts to the milling process in order to make this as quick and convenient as possible and as cheap as possible, which there's real merit to. You know, value is an important thing.
Sure.
But it's come at the expense of, frankly, the natural nutrition in this very traditional process of nixtamalization and making a tortilla from scratch. And it's also come at the expense of flavor. You know, sourcing then makes such a big difference because you can't just really taste any run-of-the-mill yellow 2 commodity corn, right? Like, you ideally want something that has a little bit more character, that's actually bred for food.
Mm. Most, and not, like,
efficiency
ethanol
or cattle feed or anything like that. So, like, basically, you know, we're really kind of sharing a lot of these same varieties and just using it and reappropriating it for food, even though it's not really designed for food. It's designed for high yield, high starch, and kind of industrial products.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, I generalize here. There are always exceptions. But, you know, by and large, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of the day, what we really want to focus on, I think, is like the pleasure that you get from something that tastes good and that nourishes you. And I knew there was something missing from tortillas in the U.S. And so when I went to Oaxaca to do research on this, you know, I grew up in full transparency. My mom was born in Mexico, but I come from a predominantly Cuban family. So my main starch was rice. And, you know, I fell in love with tortillas in that first experience when I got to Oaxaca and realized, you know, the kind of nourishment that I was missing. And it's grounded in two things. The first is sourcing, understanding that, you know, not all corn is created equal.
Sure.
You know, the second piece to it is going back to the recipe itself, you know, this process of nixtamalization and stone milling. And really, there's no science to it. I mean, there is a lot of science chemically, but from a perspective of, you know, a recipe, this is something that's it's an elusive art.
Mm.
And so that's really the thing that I think differentiates, you know, an okay tortilla from a great tortilla is the attention to detail to those two factors.
And you brought a bunch for us in a little electric comal. So
yeah,
let's taste
yeah.
Some.
This is a Mexican crepe maker. but yes. Okay. So I brought samples. The first is Guerrero, which is owned by Gruma. It's the largest tortilla behemoth in the world. They pretty much, if you've ever had a tortilla in the United States, most of it's probably been made by these folks.
Oh, wow.
I brought then also a local option, which is actually made up in Newburgh, just up the river from here in New York City.
Okay.
And I brought a Macienda tortilla. Now, what differentiates the Guerrero tortilla from the local tortilla is not much, except for the fact that one was made locally and one was made in probably a plant somewhere in the central United States.
And so now Jorge has these tortillas on this little griddle, dry, no oil, and he's just kind of, you know, twisting them and flipping them occasion. I'm watching because I'm curious about your method for reheating a tortilla also, because when I reheat tortillas at home, I do this dumb cook thing, which is like, yeah, get color on it. The things taste better when you get color on it. And then I take it off. I'm like, oh, it's kind of hard.
Yeah. I mean, there is, I mean, truly, there is no right way to heat up a tortilla. There's a way.
Thank you
that
for being judgment free.
Yeah, but I really, there's enough judgment in the world. We don't need to judge how we make a tortilla. But my favorite way personally of reheating a tortilla is to just gauge how moist it is first. You know, if you feel like it's on the drier side, adding a little bit of water on both sides is the secret that I've found to reviving any tortilla that seems dead.
Oh, cool. And so, you have a little spray mister.
Yeah, I've got a little spray mister, but
face.
Like, I could even, yeah, exactly. So yeah, just give these tortillas a little spray. I mean, the moisture that's been lost in the distribution process or just from the tortilleria to the store or wherever you're buying it,
sure.
You want to just rehydrate that a little bit. And so I do a little bit extra so it steams. And then as it's drying out on a really, really hot dry pan, when it's finishing, it'll sear. So it'll get kind of the best of both worlds. It'll lock in moisture in the center of the tortilla, which is nice, so it's pliable. But it'll also give it the kind of the nuttiness on the outside from the sear.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I do actually, do you want to taste these?
Yeah.
Awesome. So
I'm just sitting here and like, when are you going to hand me one?
So when I'm evaluating what makes a really good tortilla, the other really important part to look at is the ingredient deck. So, I mean, if you just look at this, I mean, this is the local company that I was mentioning.
Yeah.
You know, local has a really, really great connotation, but when you look at the ingredient deck, kind of loses all the romance, right? Like you're talking about like corn masa flour, propionic acid, benzoic acid, guar gum, cellulose gum. And these are tastes that most of us, and myself included, I was so accustomed to, I expected a tortilla to have that kind of bitter quality to it. And so it wasn't until I kind of retrained my palate to understand, oh my gosh, like this should
that's
taste
not
a totally
naturally
different
part
way,
of the deal,
right?
Yeah.
And then we're talking about the actual look of it. So if you're looking at a white tortilla, one of the things you want to look at is like the whiter it is. Like if it is almost like, I mean, what's the whitest thing? Like if it's like iceberg white.
Like Moby Dick white.
Moby Dick white. It's not naturally that way. Color can be deceiving, but I'll just say on the white spectrum, if it's this white, it usually means that you've got a lot of acidic products in it that are actually bleaching it, believe it or not.
So, I can actually smell.
You can smell
it's acid, and it's like it smells tart in this bag, right?
Yeah,
now.
Yeah, totally.
This
and
is
that's
one of the industrial ones,
right? Yeah. It's enough when you open the bag; you can kind of smell sort of that really strong kind of acidity and like it's kind of an acrid smell.
Mm-hmm.
When you're actually heating it up, you'll be able to get the greatest sense of it. And all these are pretty much par cooked. Most tortillas are about like 80 to 85%. So, to your question about reheating, you always want to reheat a tortilla.
Yeah.
A cold tortilla is not
no fun.
No, bueno. Not good. So. I give you sort of the two Maseca options here.
Okay, these are the industrial ones.
Yeah.
I gotta tell you, man, like, I'm smelling it. It smells a little bit, like, weirdly, like a fresh-baked brownie. Like,
yeah.
But at the same time, like, I love a tortilla, and this smells and tastes like the tortillas
right.
I know.
It tastes like a tortilla, right? Like, if we were none the wiser, it's like, all right, this is great.
Yeah. Okay, so that was like one of the industrial tortillas, and now I'm going to taste one of the Hacienda tortillas, like from original corn.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only is this a nixtamalized corn tortilla from scratch, so this has taken about 20 hours to make from scratch.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, like wine, like, you know, terroir, anything that's growing in the ground has terroir. Corn does too. And Mexico has about like 10,000 years on the United States insofar as how long it's been growing corn. So it's, you know, it like makes sense that it's going to taste better at that origin.
All right. So I know you're leading the witness a little bit, but I mean, visually, I can see a little bit of that more yellow color. It's a little bit of a richer color. Smelling it off the griddle, I don't get any of that sort of sourness. It smells like there's someone grilling food off in the distance. And if I was really going to be super picky about it, it almost tastes like a really good piece of grilled shrimp that it sounds so weird to say it because it doesn't taste like shrimp, but
right.
It evokes some of that toasted shell flavor. I don't even know where this is coming from. I sound like a crazy person.
It's sort of like I totally hear what you're saying. It's that sort of like that natural sweetness that you find in shrimp.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with this. I mean, we're talking about a corn variety that this particular one is called Oldo Tio. Mm. We fell in love with this because of its naturally high oil content. So there's sort of a lingering. What's really cool about this is that when you really start to pay attention, you start to realize that the flavor will be left sort of in your mouth for a lot longer on your palate because of the natural oils. You know, your mouth is literally being coated by oils that aren't present in commodity corn. So it's not actually that far off that you're talking about shrimp, right? There's sort of like a natural sweetness to it that's definitely present.
That's wild.
Yeah.
This is amazing. Thank you so much for coming in today, Jorge.
Thank you so much, Francis. It was really a pleasure.
Jorge Gaviria is the CEO of Hacienda. Now, whether you're using heirloom corn masa or just the masa flour called Maseca you can find in a grocery store, we have a great recipe for fresh tortillas you can make at home from the chef Alex Stupak. You can find that on splendidtable.org. Coming up...
Here you are with this beautiful sauce, this chili sauce with tomatoes and onion, garlic, and chicken. And you've got a tray full of tortilla chips that you've made. And this will feel strange if you've never done it before, but you need to drop those chips into the sauce and stir them in.
That's Tucker Shaw on the best reason to turn your chips soggy. Chilaquiles. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. When I was in high school in suburban New Jersey, my cousin and I would just go and crush bags of Taco Bell tacos. I mean, I think at one point we were eating like 9 of them apiece with some Mexi-Melts thrown in for variety. We weren't even stoners, but we just ate like it. And honestly, I think that was about it for my exposure to Mexican food. Today, Taco Bell serves 2 billion customers a year, so I bet that's the first taste of Mexican food for plenty of people.
And you know, at some point I came to realize that the food at Taco Bell isn't really a whole lot like the food people usually eat in Mexico, but it does come from somewhere. And there is one Mexican restaurant in San Bernardino, California, that should really get the credit for birthing the Taco Bell taco to begin with. It's the Mitla Cafe, a Calmex landmark since 1937, one of the oldest Mexican restaurants in Southern California. It's a pillar of the Chicano community, a base for political activism against segregation, and it still serves those original crunchy tacos. Reporter Lisa Morehouse brings us there.
Want something tasty and delicious? Taco Bell, Taco Bell.
In this commercial from the 1980s, Taco Bell declared its Americanized Mexican food original. But folks who gather at the Mitla Cafe tell a different story.
So in the 1950s, Glen Bell had a hot dog stand across the street from the Mitla Cafe.
People would be lined up to buy the tacos at a little window by the kitchen.
10-cent tacos. We used to come get a dozen and we'd have so much fun.
And they were really, really good hamburger tacos.
Glen Bell, he noticed that we did a lot of business with our tacos.
And so he kind of would come into the Mitla Cafe, look at their menu, see how they operated.
My great-grandfather, Salvador, he brought him into the kitchen and kind of showed him how we did it. And I think he took the concept and ran with it from there to what Taco Bell is today.
But head over to Mitla's today, and no one's talking about Taco Bell. It's a weekday at 11 in the morning, and the Mitla Cafe is packed. Co-owner Steve Okendo weaves through tables and booths, joking with customers about baseball and asking after family members. The first draw is the food. The menu looks almost exactly like it did when Okendo's great-grandmother, Lucia Rodriguez, was cooking here over 75 years ago.
I've been coming here ever since I was a kid, and I really think that this hot sauce is in my bloodstream.
Drew Negrete says once his parents picked him up at the airport after a two-month stint overseas, and all he could say was,
I just need to go to Mitla's. I think I ate it for like 5 days straight, to be honest with you. You just miss it. You miss it.
And you miss the people you get with the food. Today, Negrete came in with his parents and ran into half a dozen family members. Community college faculty meet up here. So does the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce and the Kiwanis Club. And the Mitla Cafe is a necessary stop for political incumbents and hopefuls. Steve Okendo.
I like to joke with the people running for office that if they don't have their meetings here, they're not going to get elected.
Politicians and activists have come here since the 1930s.
Did you see the picture of my grandma and Cesar Chavez up front? He used to eat here.
When the labor leader organized nearby grape pickers. The Mitla Cafe has always been a place where ideas and action develop. Here's historian Mark Oseguela, a San Bernardino native.
The city restricted Mexicans to living on the west side. So there was school segregation. There was segregation in public theaters. In the workplace, in the Santa Fe Railroad, there was the Mexican restrooms and there was the white restrooms.
And there was segregation at the city's only public pool at a park called Harris Hill.
And Mexicans were only allowed to use it one day out of the week, the day before the pool was meant to be drained and cleaned.
During the same time period, in the 30s and 40s, Mitla Cafe proprietor Salvador Rodriguez rallied the neighborhood's strong business leaders, former city councilwoman Esther Estrada.
They had formed the Mexican Chamber of Commerce. They would go and meet at Mitla's to discuss the politics of the community.
They threw fiestas for important Mexican holidays. They wore elaborate costumes and rode horseback at charro parades. And the Mitla Cafe sponsored a whole neighborhood baseball team.
It was very common for Mexican-American baseball teams to just find a vacant lot within the barrio to clear the land and create a baseball diamond because they couldn't do this in other parts of the city. And it would draw literally thousands of people.
Mark Osegueda says these were political acts. The Mitla Cafe was building civic and racial pride. Esther Estrada.
We come from the 60s and 70s generation. We were raised at a time where it's absolutely proper to hit the streets and advocate. In the 30s and the 40s, maybe in those days it had to be more subtle, but they got things done also.
Business, civic, and church leaders who met at the Mitla Cafe to organize formed the Mexican American Defense Committee and sued the city for access to that public pool.
And in 1944, the decision went in favor of the Mexican American Defense Committee, and it desegregated public pools, parks, and recreational facilities for Mexican Americans in the city of San Bernardino.
This served as precedent for the case that would desegregate schools in California.
And that, in turn, served as precedent for the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education, in 1954.
The late 40s and 50s were vibrant days for the Mitla Cafe and the neighborhood. Mitla waitress Lucy Reyes.
You want to know when I first started working
here?
Yes, I do. 1951, I think.
Route 66 ran down Mount Vernon Avenue, and many locals worked in solid manufacturing jobs.
It was real lively. A lot of little businesses. We had a big grocery store at the corner and two tortillerias. Well, we had the theater, Azteca, for all Mexican movies. Pedro Infante, Luis Aguilar, and it would get killed up.
What happened next is a familiar story. Across the country, urban development nearly amputated once vibrant African-American and immigrant neighborhoods. In San Bernardino, when the new freeway opened in 1959, there were no exit ramps into Mexican-American neighborhoods. Again, former city councilwoman Esther Estrada.
It was our own Berlin Wall because it had shut us off from the downtown. It had brought the demise of our businesses on the west side.
Last year, westbound off-ramps were added to the freeway, but those old scars remain. Walk along Mount Vernon Avenue now and you'll pass empty lots and vacant storefronts.
You see the blight. You see the bars on the window. I don't see that when I come here because I'm from here. My hood, my barrio, no. It's a beautiful place.
So, does Mitla co-owner Steve Oquendo ever think about Taco Bell, get resentful that his family never saw dividends from those hamburger tacos?
Not at all. I wouldn't change where we're at for the world. I really wouldn't. If we had ever gotten that big, I don't think I would have that sense of responsibility and pride that I have now. Our customers come here for gut feeling, that soul feeling, that home feeling. It's a meeting place. And you can't take that away.
Maybe that attitude is key to Mitla's survival. Four generations of owners kept the original menu and stayed right here.
That story was produced by reporter Lisa Morehouse and is part of her series, California Foodways. It's supported by California Humanities and FERN, the Food and Environment Reporting Network. From an old Mexican-American community to one of the newest. Steven Alvarez is a professor of English who teaches a writing course called Taco Literacy. It's a class where students learn how to read Mexican cuisine and learn about communities by talking to people and writing about their food. And yes, the homework involves eating tacos, but what really struck me about this class was where he taught it. We join my conversation with Steven as he's answering the question, why did he teach that class at the University of Kentucky?
Sure. Well, before I taught taco literacy, I was actually teaching a class called Mexington, Kentucky. And in that class, I was really exploring the demographic changes happening in Kentucky. Kentucky has one of the fastest growing Latino populations in the country. At this point, I believe they're tied for number three. Most of these states are located in the South. So the South itself is also experiencing a sort of Latinization or transformation. And I took the students to a local taqueria. And I realized how excited they were. They were so happy and they were so curious. And at that point, I was thinking I could do a class that would do basically the same kind of general framework for exploring Latin Kentucky through food. So food became the kind of prism by which we would still explore some of these social and demographic changes.
You noted that the population is growing really quickly. Why Kentucky?
Well, primarily the horse industry. and also the agricultural industry. And really, it's happening between the areas of Lexington and to the west, Louisville, or Louisville. Sometimes I still catch myself saying Louisville, pardon. And the area of Lexington that's to the west side, relatively close to Keeneland Racetrack and also the airport, is where the primarily Mexican population concentrated. And that's the area that was pejoratively referred to as Mexington. However, when I arrived, as a growing kind of Kentucky Mexican identity has emerged, Mexington has become a place to be proud of, a place even honored, and a place where folks feel a sense of pride as that's their neighborhood. So I would say it's not only just the agricultural kind of pool in the horse industry, but there was also other states where Latinos felt less welcome and migrated to Kentucky after learning about the cost of living and the opportunities available.
But you also say that Mexican Kentucky identity has emerged, and because you're studying it through food, how do you see that in the food, or do you?
Well, it happens in a couple different ways, I would say. On one hand, there is the large regional varieties of Mexican food that have been popping up more in Kentucky. That is food from Veracruz, from the Yucatan, from Aguascalientes, from the northern states of Mexico, and also from the southern states, Oaxaca and Puebla. Folks coming from all over Mexico coming to Kentucky. But you're also seeing this kind of exploration of using local ingredients to enrich Mexican food. And by that, I mean, for example, there's a place called the Ville Taqueria in Louisville that has bourbon marinated carnitas. And it's as good as it sounds.
Cool.
And also, another one of my favorite spots in Lexington, right in the heart of Mexington, is Tortilleria Taqueria Ramirez that uses Weizenberger mill corn from Midway, Kentucky, so famous for their grits. So these are Kentucky tortillas with local corn. And it's that attention also to the rich agricultural wealth of Kentucky for the kinds of ingredients that are available that also creates this kind of hybridity.
I mean, I remember reading about your work from a terrific writer, Gustavo Arellano, who is a newspaperman and a columnist, and he's written a column for a long time called Ask a Mexican, which is an amazing name for a newspaper column. And he said that you are a student of how not just the South is changing Mexican immigrants, but how Mexican food is changing the South. So now we know about the bourbon marinated carnitas. Tell us about the other side of that coin. How are these Mexican communities changing the South?
I think Gustavo is probably one of the forefront, not only just Mexican food writers in the country and even the world, but really at the forefront of exploring the transformations happening in the South. Some of the stuff that the work he's done for Southern Foodways Alliance, including some of the oral histories and profiles of different restaurant owners and restaurants, have been incredible and really open up a way of thinking about exploring the local lived experiences of folks in Kentucky. In my own experience, in my research, I really explore immigration largely. And by being in Kentucky, I think connecting with food has been something that's enriched my research. That is, though I usually explore literacy and bilingualism, exploring that through food has been a way for me to think about how literacy is connected to care. Care and also a social connection to care, which strikes me as the same as with food, that I think food and literacy are deeply wound together, and especially the stories surrounding both food and how we learn language. So I would say for me, that's been a really rich point in terms of my own research, but no doubt about it, Gustavo has been a huge influence. He's probably the one of the only Mexican-American folks I know who actually actively vacations to Kentucky every year, makes a pilgrimage. But he also makes it a point to try some of these, I guess you would say, places where you order Mexican food by the plate number in some of the very, very rural areas. And it's really interesting. I mean, you can go out into Holler, parts of eastern Kentucky, and you will always find a Mexican restaurant. And that's, I think that's telling, because that's when in many places, some of these rural communities, especially in Appalachia, where folks are getting their taste of Mexican culture through the food. And it may not be necessarily the folks that would consider, quote unquote, authentic, although it has its own realness. And that beats authenticity. Yeah. But it's also that social connection. I think that, you know, even in harsh political times, that food can bring people to the table.
That's great. I love that realness and social connection. Thank you so much, Steve.
It was nice talking to you.
Steven Alvarez is an assistant professor of English at St. John's University, and his latest book is called Brokering Tareas. So much of Mexican food is about the interplay between tortillas and a sauce, like enchiladas, or eating mole or a soup with a tortilla for dipping, or, one of my favorite dishes, chilaquiles. Our producer, Sally Swift, talked with Tucker Shaw about America's Test Kitchen's take on this classic.
Hey, Tucker, nice to have you back.
Hey, Sally, thanks for having me.
I want to talk today about a dish that I actually don't know very much about, chilaquiles. Will you describe them for us?
Yum.
This is a great topic to discuss. Chilaquiles is sort of a stew. It's sort of built on dried chilies and tomatoes or tomatillos, whichever way you go, maybe some chicken, maybe some eggs. And the essential ingredient is tortilla chips that you stir into the stew to soften. And the chips really give it a really lovely deep corn flavor, mm-hmm. but it's an unusual way to use your chips.
And is this dish Mexican or Tex-Mex? What are the origins?
Kind of all of the above and then some. Tortillas predate Europeans arriving in North America by quite a while. So I think that most dishes that are primarily built on tortillas certainly have roots farther back than the Spanish arrival. So I would venture to say that this dish, or a very, very similar, you know, close cousin to it, is probably older than even the idea of Mexico.
Wow. That's something to wrap your head around. Okay, so the chips, because they are so seminal in this dish, can go bad in a lot of ways. So what did you decide about chips?
It can go south for sure. So because the main function of the chips here are to add sort of some bulk and also some really deep roasted corn flavor, you want to be able to have chips that don't introduce too many other things like salt, and that also maintain their integrity after a little bit of time in that sauce. So they should soften, but they shouldn't get too soggy.
So store-bought chips aren't going to work perfectly in this dish. Is that what you discovered?
No. Yeah. Okay. I mean, variance between brands really gives a very, very different result. Some store-bought chips are super thick, some are super thin, some are super salty. In order to control the chips going in, we decided to make our own, and honestly, it's really not that hard.
Okay, how did you do them? Did you deep fry them?
So that's one way you could do it, for sure. But we use the oven instead, because what you're really looking for isn't like a shatteringly crisp chip. You just want something that's toasted and has a little bit of a crunch to it before it goes into the dish. So you basically take some corn tortillas, cut them into triangles, toss them with a little bit of oil, and you bake them in the oven for 15 minutes, maybe 20 minutes, something like that, until they're pretty crisp. And the hard part is to, like, not actually just sit there and eat all the chips, but to set them aside to use in your dish later.
Okay, so the chips are ready. Talk to us about the sauce.
So we build our sauce primarily on dried guajillo chilies, which you can find in most grocery stores these days. So these are beautiful, deep red, almost jewel-toned dried peppers. And you toss them dry into a Dutch oven to toast them for a few minutes. And just that period of heating them over a dry heat really kind of blooms their flavor and releases some of the oils and gives you a really strong, deep flavor base. So then you take them out and you drop them in the blender with some jalapenos, fresh jalapenos, and fresh poblanos. So you're using three different peppers here, which gives you sort of a wide range of pepper flavors all at once. So you're getting fruity, you're getting heat, you're getting all these kind of redolent, beautiful expressions of peppers in there. You toss in some canned tomatoes, some onion and garlic, and cilantro, and you blitz it really until it's pretty smooth. You return that back to the Dutch oven and start it heating up. And because we make our chilaquiles with chicken in this recipe, you drop in a couple of chicken breasts and let them poach for a while. So this probably takes about 15 minutes. You yank those out when they're done, put them aside, and you start to reduce the sauce a little bit because it will be a little bit thinner than what you're looking for in the final dish because you do want a fairly, you know, a sauce that will stick to your fork. While that sauce is reducing, you simply shred the chicken using a couple of forks to pull it apart as you would, and stir them back into the sauce. And so here you are with this beautiful sauce, this chili sauce with tomatoes and onion, garlic, and chicken. And you've got a tray full of tortilla chips that you've made. And this will feel strange if you've never done it before, but you need to drop those chips into the sauce and stir them in.
Okay.
And then you cover the dish and let them sit for anywhere from 2 to 5 minutes. And that's really up to you. Some people like their chips in chilaquiles to sort of maintain a real, I guess, al dente-ness, for lack of a better word. Some people like them a little bit softer. But you want to leave them in there long enough so that they don't come out sort of shatteringly crisp and they're able to distribute some of that really deep corn flavor throughout your sauce. And then, of course, you load it up with, you know, some cilantro, some queso fresco, maybe like some sliced radishes, any way you want to kind of dress it up to kind of finish off the dish.
That sounds delicious. Tucker, thank you.
Thanks, Sally.
Tucker Shaw is editor-in-chief of Cook's Country, and you can find that recipe for chicken chilaquiles at splendidtable.org. Coming up, a lesson in flan from Mexican sweets master Fanny Gerson. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. Wesley Avila is a Mexican-American son of Los Angeles who was a forklift driver, then became a fine dining chef, then started running Guerrilla Tacos, what's been called the best taco truck in L.A. And his whole approach to making tacos isn't about tradition. It's about thinking about the taco as a form, or really as a way of life. It's about how you can make delicious tacos out of anything. Now, he's not a total anarchist, and there are some rules to making great tacos out of asparagus or potatoes or last night's leftover sausages. Here he is, giving our contributor Russ Parsons the lowdown.
Wesley Avila, welcome to Splendid Table.
Thanks for having me, Russ.
You know, everybody loves tacos, but I think for a lot of people still, it's something that you go out and you buy rather than something that you make at home. So let's go over some of the basics about how you make great tacos at home. What are the things that you should already have on hand and ready to go when you start?
Great tortillas. That's where it starts, either flour or corn. And then some kind of fat, whether it be butter, lard, nice olive oil to keep those tortillas warm. I warm mine up with a little bit of butter because growing up in Southern California, we grew up eating tortillas with butter. So even on the truck, I tend to use a lot of butter on my tortillas. And then either tomatoes or tomatillos to make some kind of salsa. And then there's the chilies. I mean, you can get dry chilies, fresh chilies, some kind of garlic, shallot, or onion, and whatever kind of filling you'd like, whether it be some kind of fish protein, meat, pork, vegetables, and some kind of acid herb kind of thing going on, using cilantro or some parsley or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So you've got everything set up. You're ready to go. What are the steps in construction?
The first thing you can do ahead of time is make your salsa. Whether you got tomatoes or tomatillos, you can roast them, you can do them raw, you can boil them, you can simmer them. You can do a lot of different ways. Like, it's like many ways to do a different sauce. The way I like to do it is roasting them over fire. You can makeshift it with a little grate over your fire burner. You want to get some nice color on your tomatoes, onion, serrano. And if you can't get fresh chilies, you can always order dry chilies, guajillo or chile de arbol, so different things like that. But just you need to be careful with like chile de arbol or the smaller, spicier ones, because when you start roasting in-house, you'll notice, you'll see what it's like to grow up in a house here in Southern California. Like growing up, my mom would make chile de arbol. She roasts them with a little bit of lard, but we would be like so dramatic little kids, you know, it would be like pepper spray in the house and we'd have to like kneel down and go through the kitchen because it was just too spicy. You'd be coughing up a storm, your eyes would be watering. So you just be a little careful with the roasting of those. So we roast all our stuff till they're nice. You got a nice char on them, pop it in the blender with some salt and some kind of acid, whether it be fresh lime or white vinegar, things like that.
Okay, so now we've got the basics. Let's go a little bit deeper. What are the qualities of a great taco? What should every great taco have in it?
For me, there are some key points. A warm tortilla, a nice savory filling, and it's got to have enough heft to it. So if you're going to have something that's lighter, like a light fish, it's got to have some butter. Or if it's going to be some vegetables, like some asparagus, the salsa itself has to be more rich. So it's like an almond salsa, a pumpkin seed kind of salsa. And speaking of the salsa, a spicy salsa, because for me, I don't like bland food. I like food that's nuanced and restrained with purpose. But if you're doing tacos, I feel it should be spicy, savory, crunchy, and then some fresh herbs for sure. That's key for me in any tacos and any combination of ingredients. As long as it has those things, you're on the right track.
And what about acidity? I've noticed with your tacos, it's like there's a backbone there that kind of helps define the flavor.
Yeah, there's definitely a pop to our tacos, whether it be fresh lime that we add to the salsas, or we do this thing called salsa bruja, which is a lime juice, sugar, fish sauce, garlic, serranos, and you mix that up, and that's kind of the acid we use on all our tostadas. It adds a lot of flavor, but yeah, there's definitely acid in every taco I do. especially the ones that are rich, like, you know, carnitas, things like that, definitely going to have some acid.
You know, the tacos you make at Gorilla Tacos are really, they're fine dining tacos. What are your favorite tacos to make at home?
My favorite tacos to make at home are probably the ones where you take yesterday's dinner and make today's lunch. Like, for instance, I had sausages from the Alpine Village left over from a barbecue. And these are just German brats, you know, Bavarian vice versa. So, you know, they're already cooked, ready to go. So what I'll get is chop them up, mix them with some onion, some serrano chili, and just kind of saute that together and warm up whatever kind of tortilla I have. Add that and usually any kind of salsa I have. The salsa that I have that I would normally have at the house would be something like a arbol chile or a roasted tomato chile. We do a raw tomatillo salsa, but that's better used in 1 to 2 days. So when you have a raw salsa, it's like gazpacho or any kind of fresh thing. You want to have it when it's bright and fresh. And the roasted ones tend to last for about a week, even 2 weeks if they're really spicy.
That sounds wonderful. Wesley Avila, thank you so much for being on Splendid Table.
Thanks for having me.
Wesley Avila is the author of Gorilla Tacos. Russ Parsons' book is How to Pick a Peach, and Wesley left us with the recipes for the sauces he talked about, roasted tomatillo salsa and arbol salsa. You can find them at splendidtable.org. Lots of chefs cook from the heart, but you could say that the pastry chef Fanny Gerson cooks from a broken heart. Now, her desserts always make me smile, and that's her point, because once, when she was in Mexico researching the recipes she grew up with, her husband dropped her an email saying he wanted a divorce. And to work her way through the shock and pain of that moment, Fanny decided she needed to come back to America and, in her words, share the sweetness of Mexico. She's a wonderful chef and a master of Mexican ice creams and ice pops called paletas. And so I met up with her in her paleta factory. That's the noise you'll hear in the background. For a lesson in Mexican dessert making. So, hola, Fanny.
Hola.
Thank you so much for having us here.
Thank you for being here. I'm very excited, and I love talking about sweets, particularly Mexican sweets.
All right, and you're going to show us how to make your flan.
Yes.
Awesome.
Flan is a type of custard. A custard is very versatile, and I think it's much simpler than it often seems.
Okay.
So if we can head to the kitchen. It's a bit noisy in there. There's paleta making, lots of stuff going on. But
so here we are in your kitchen by your stove. You have a very simple setup. I mean, you have salt, sugar, vanilla, eggs and egg yolks, and a little bit of Mexican cinnamon.
Yep. And then we have some milk in the back that has been steeping. It's milk and a little bit of heavy cream.
Okay.
And yeah, so this is like an old-fashioned flan. There's many different versions, but this is my sister's favorite recipe.
Oh,
so
sweet.
Yes.
Awesome.
And I love Mexican cinnamon. I want you to smell this.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Isn't that amazing? In this recipe, you know, there's people that use cinnamon, some people use vanilla bean, some use lemon zest or lime. Really, we don't use a lot of lemon in Mexico, or a combination.
Yeah.
So really, you can make this flan to suit your particular taste. I happen to love cinnamon, and it's very nostalgic. So to me, the fact that it's an old-fashioned flan has to have
the cinnamon. Yeah. And I forgot to mention the first step, which you've already done and set up for us, which you made a simple caramel.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like a nice amber, and poured it in the pan that you're going to cook the flan in, right?
Yeah, so we have this already, it's chilled. And then the next step is to take the milk and the cream that were brought up to a simmer with the cinnamon, and they've been steeping for about 15 minutes or so. And then the next thing we're going to do is we're going to strain it.
Okay. So you're just putting it right through a fine mesh strainer, just catch all the little bits of cinnamon.
Yeah. You want to make sure that this is still warm. And next step is you're going to mix the sugar with the
milk.
As long as the sugar dissolves,
you're fine.
You're fine.
Yeah.
You can just continue making the flan off the stove.
Okay.
If it hasn't dissolved, then you just put it back just for a couple of minutes. Keep on stirring until it's dissolved.
Okay, so you've mixed the sugar into the warm milk. And here come the eggs.
Yeah, so now we're going to put... It's a mixture of eggs and yolks.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you're going to find so many recipes, but essentially the technique is the same, and you should just get the technique down and then just have the confidence to play around depending on the texture you want. Right. So mix this, the eggs, lightly. You don't want to whip them too much.
Okay.
So then you're going to add a little bit of salt.
A pinch of salt.
A pinch of salt. And then just a little bit of vanilla.
Just a little splash of vanilla.
A little splash of vanilla. And then you just want to make sure it's mixed. So you do want to get as much of these streaks gone.
Okay.
But don't stress over it. Yeah. You know, everything's going to get mixed. Okay. You're going to take your hot milk with the sugar in it that's been infused with the cinnamon. And you're going to take a part of it, and then you're going to put it in the eggs. Okay. This is what we call tempering.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The reason why you do this and you don't pour the eggs directly into the hot liquid is because you'll make sweet scrambled eggs. Yeah. That won't be good.
So you've added a little bit of the warm milk to the eggs and just whisked it in. Mm-hmm. And you're gently bringing up the temperature of the eggs with the warm milk, but not so much that you cook it.
So then you just whisk it. Again, you don't want to add a lot of air to it. You're not trying to whip the eggs. You just want to make sure they're well incorporated, right?
Right.
So now we're going to pour the flan mixture into the pan that has the caramel that's been cooled down.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like to do sort of a strain again, just in case, because sometimes when you break the eggs, they have a little bit of shell.
Sure.
So we're going to pour it directly. You put the colander directly on top of the flan.
Oh, and it's just like streaming in so beautifully.
Yeah.
All right, and then when you're ready, you go in the oven in a water bath.
Yeah, so we're going to cover it with aluminum foil. You don't want to cover it too tight because that's going to create steam. Mm-hmm. So you can puncture a couple of holes in the foil, actually. And then you put it in a water bath. So you want to take a baking pan that is bigger, but at least just as tall, if not taller, than your flan mold. So you put the flan mold inside a pan, and then you put it in the oven. And then I like to pour the water directly
into the larger pan to surround the flan.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Do you put boiling water, or is it just?
I just use tap water that's very hot. You don't need to boil it. Very simple.
Yeah. And that protects the flan as it bakes, so the outside, like the edge of the flan, doesn't bake too fast.
Exactly. So in a custard, you want things to cook slowly.
Yeah. And you're just babying it the whole time.
You're just babying it the whole time. And then each oven, I always say, like, when it comes to flan, you know, sometimes even the same recipe for me, like, sometimes can take, let's say, 50 minutes, and other times it can take, like, an hour and 15 minutes. Mm. So I think a lot of it depends on, you know, what the exact temperature it was, you know, but what you're looking for is that when you take it out, you're going to shake it and it's going to, you know, kind of jiggle in the center a little bit, but the edges are set.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
And then the hardest part is this, because once you take it out, you have to cool it and refrigerate it. So you have to be very patient.
So the hardest part is waiting
to eat it. The hardest part is waiting to eat it, but, you know, patience has its rewards. So I'm going to pop this in the oven now, but I actually made one ahead so that you didn't have to wait till tomorrow.
The magic of radio.
Exactly. Although I have to say, we had an issue with the oven that I didn't realize until this morning when I came in, because when we unmolded it, it fell apart. And I was like, what happened? I mean, we've done this many times. But it's still going to taste.
It's real life.
It happens. You know, it's not as beautiful as we'd like it to be.
All right. So here it is. It did crackle around a little. But just around the edge, it's obviously not a big deal. But this is beautiful because I guess, I don't know why this happens, but it seems like the caramel in the pan mixes with the base a little bit as it bakes. And so when you unmold it, it kind of has its own sauce. Like the caramel bakes directly onto it, but some of it sort of runs off and it's this beautiful, loose, sort of like syrupy sauce out of it.
It's amazing.
Okay, let's go for a bite. Oh, man.
Mm.
It's so velvety. It's so smooth and beautiful. It's so delicious.
Thank you.
I'm literally drooling right now. I can't talk. Thank you so much for showing me how to make this.
Thank you. Thank you for stopping by. Come back soon.
I will.
Please.
Fanny Gerson is the chef owner of La New Yorkina and has written three books about Mexican sweets. The newest is called Mexican Ice Cream, beloved recipes and stories. You can find her recipe for a flan at splendidtable.org. Well, that's our show for the week. I hope you enjoyed this sort of incomplete tour of Mexican food in America, and please join us again next week. And in the meantime, make tacos, not war. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen, delivers a recipe straight to your inbox every Wednesday. Sign up at splendidtable.org. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.